Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Good afternoon, everybody. The question on the sheet says collaboration or competition, and the answer is collaboration. Thank you. I'm struck, and I arrive in this at a sort of late stage in the proceedings, so that the urge to want to sum up or intervene in the gathering discussion is sort of powerful on me just at the moment. And it does strike me that collectively we construct a discourse which is full of polar, not in the Arctic sense, you understand, categories, where we have intellectual endeavour over on one side and relevance on the other. Skills over here, knowledge over here, the academic over here, the vocational over there, employment over there, study over there, higher education over here, further education over there. And it strikes me that the purpose of what we're doing is not further to separate or distinguish those things, but better to connect them. So I don't particularly want to get drawn into a kind of tisn't, if you like, between those things. But I want to try and navigate some of the sort of the twin features of the landscape. And I will do that, James, by way of the Canadian border, strangely enough, as we'll see in a moment. And there's another kind of polarity here. These phrases are two sort of trailers or teasers for this conference which Neil Stewart Associates put out. So you got an email to, you know, excite you further about the prospect of coming here today. And one of them said, how FE colleges can compete with universities. And then another one that came along said, HE and FE colleges creating a sustainable model. And I did faintly wonder what sort of conference it would be if the teaser was how universities can compete with FE colleges and what kind of discussion that might lead to. I'm going to steer a safer course than that and try and focus on the sustainability rather than the punch-up, as it were. Forgive me for the long quotation, which I'm not even going to read all of. There are a number of reasons for putting this before you. One of them, it's the only instance of a joint publication between me and my then vice-chancellor, now the director of OFA, so I'm terribly proud of it, so I show it off everywhere I go. But I want to sort of try and focus on this thing about values and beliefs within this. And in the middle it says, universities are good at widening access when they clearly understand this is one of the main things they're for. Universities are, in our view, agents of social transformation, and we go on to argue that excellence in the achievement of that should be weighed alongside other measures of excellence in the higher education sector. But its chief function here is to say that in times like this, one of the things you have to do is remember what you're for and stick to doing it, because the policy environment will blow you all over the place, and the tactical tacking that you are obliged to undertake, and which I don't in any sense look down upon, can leave you in a position which is very different from the one you set off to steer towards. So I wanted to just kind of put at the core of our purposes at Bedfordshire this business about transforming society in the direction of greater equality, greater participation, greater social justice, which is one of the key reasons why we're very interested in the relationship between higher and further education. We did a piece of work for HEFCE, which had the rather grand title, Bringing the Tapestry Together, Systemic Partnership Within and Beyond Bedfordshire, which is snappy, perhaps not. And in that, we talked about the need to bridge perceptual and attitudinal barriers between HE, FE and schools in the minds of learners. And in the third point, we talked about the aim being to improve the life chances and opportunities for those who would otherwise not have them. And I want, again, to kind of assert that as the part of the philosophical bedrock of what we're concerned about in my university with our partnership with universities. Like other higher education providers, we have published access agreements. Uniquely among universities, I face the prospect of having the next access agreement being reviewed by the former VC. I'm sure that he'll be exceptionally rigorous in his critique of that. But one of the key groups there is learners from low participation neighbourhoods. And I just want to zero in on that. It's been mentioned a couple of times already. I'm slightly worried about Hefke say FE equals WP. That doesn't sound... But if you look at the figures, new young full-time first degree entrants registered at FECs count for about 23% of the population, whereas in HEIs, in universities, they account for about 10% of the population. That's a massive difference. So at a very simple level, if you're in earnest about reaching out to learners who come from geographical areas where participation in higher education is low, then the relationship to your local further education colleges is of absolutely critical performance. For a little place, Bedfordshire has quite an extensive network of partnerships. For a county which only occupies three junctions of the M1, it spreads out a bit in terms of its partners. It reaches at its northernmost to Nottingham, at its westernmost to Oxford, and at its easternmost nowadays, although not on this map, to Stamford. So we have a broad and extensive partnership, and that partnership contains about 3,000 students. That's about 3,000 students in a university which has, including them, about 24,000 students. As a proportion of the UK population, that 3,000 is very significant indeed. So it matters to us enormously that those partnerships are healthy. And we've been proud of the nature of the relationships that we've established throughout the last decade, and the stability and cordiality, by and large, of the partnerships in which we operate. And then you get a letter. You're going along, life seems all right, and you get a letter, and it's going to be different now. It's not going to be the same thing at all, and there's lots of kind of swallowing and considering and thinking about it and trying to work out where we think we now are. And this, for us, given the things I was just saying about the importance and significance of the partnerships, the numbers of students involved, the erstwhile stability and recent cordiality of those partnerships, such a communication alongside the announcements that our student numbers will be cut. So we did not set our fee at the level that would take us into the quorum margin operation directly ourselves. We had a reduction in our own student numbers, and there was this contestability, if you like, in the availability of numbers for FE. So back before the quorum margin communication, those students that I was describing to you a moment ago are funded through the university using indirect funding into our partner colleges. Now, as we'll see in a moment, that is not the case. The picture is reversed, and the massively overwhelming majority of those students are now directly funded through quorum margin arrangements in those colleges. What we decided to do was to work with our partner colleges actively to support their bids for numbers so that we could protect the provision. That was our overriding purpose in doing that. So I worked with people who were emergent competitors to help them establish their bids for those numbers. And thus began, should have said that a minute ago really, because we've got over that now, thus began what I was struck by as the walk of death. This is true, not that I went on a walk of death, but this, what is in front of you, is true. In June of this year, a chap called Nick Wallander, no relation of the famous Swedish detective, walked across a tightrope, not the first person in history to do it, but probably actually the last at the moment person in history to do it, across Niagara Falls on a tightrope. And the walk of death was how this was built. And his job effectively was to get from one side to the other alive, to straddle the divide. And I was very struck by this because, apart from anything else, it strikes me that this is a nice metaphor for the business of trying to kind of navigate that transition from pre-core and margin to now, and to navigate the relationship between further and higher education. Not that the risks that faced us as a university or me as an individual were quite so vertiginous as the kind of 220-foot drop. And I think the thing that particularly strikes me, I don't know if you can see it on the slide, is that this takes 40 minutes to do. So stepping out onto the rope is one thing, but you get halfway across and decide it was a bad idea. Your options are pretty limited at that point. But then I started to think that actually, although it's very clear what the difference between Canada and the United States is, it's not all that clear at what point those differences begin to emerge. So you can tell a Canadian they're American and you can stand well clear and so on. And yet, where is the line actually? Where is the border on there? And there is, I'm sure, that on a map somewhere, and if I tried to cross it, I'd probably have sort of American helicopters interested in me and so on. But although it may well be defined, it's actually not that easy to work out what it is about it that's not arbitrary, and that's the same, it seems to me, in many respects, as the difference between further and higher education. The view that he faced, contemplating stepping out onto the rope, was uncertain as to the eventual outcome, one might say. And we all have to do this. We have to take steps into the foggy, the uncertain, the rocky, the wobbly, maybe not terrifying, I don't want to ham it up too much. Working in higher education isn't quite as exciting as that. But he had to step out onto that rope without being able to see the other side. And I think that I think that is something we have to be prepared to do in negotiating between partners. And there he is. I promised myself that I would say before I started to say any of this that it all worked out all right. You know, he did make it. He did get to the other side. He made landfall in Canada. But one can only wonder at his trepidation as he. Maybe not. Maybe it's a breeze, and he doesn't understand why more people don't do it. I don't know. Before I show that, that's a very uncomfortable situation to be betwixt and between. And those of us who work from the higher education side, or those of us who work from the further education side, have to be accustomed to and willing to tolerate discomfort. But we have to be careful that we don't simply find a safe place to stand where you can't get to anywhere else from. And that's what St. Simon Stylites is doing in the presentation. He's occupying a pillar where he has no danger of falling and no prospect of connecting with anybody else. And it seems to me that that's exactly the opposite of what one seeks to achieve. Core and margin and its impact on the University of Bedfordshire. The before and after picture. Before we went into the exercise, we had about 3,000 partnership students. We still do. We had 4 active partnership networks. We still have. We had 11 active partners. We have 2 more. And it's not net more. We kept them all and we added 2 more. We had about 34 academic awards and we now have 34 academic awards. There is some slight net adjustment. There are 2 awards withdrawn from and added to that list in the natural kind of evolution of the life cycle of higher education and further education provision. From the point of view of the learner, the impact is probably undetectable. They can do the courses they wanted to do in the places they wanted to do them. They can progress to the university on the same terms, and those terms may be susceptible of improvement in the ways that we've heard discussed. But the cataclysm, if you like, the catastrophic fall, did not occur yet. Don't want to acquire any kind of reputation for complacency. And it wasn't, for us, mayhem. There was tension. It was difficult. Where it was most difficult was where we communicated poorly, where we helped to bring about the development of misunderstandings or strains on trust or whatever. But the upshot was that we maintained something very close to the status quo, and we continue to operate not as if nothing had happened, but as if the partnership itself, the collaboration itself, was of value to the partners. And we had some comments earlier on about the cost of validation. I'd like to challenge the notion that what my university does with its partners is validate. That's got a sort of hit and run quality to it. There's a kind of, you know, sort of we appear, sanction and clear off. We seek a much more profound relationship than that with our partners and with their and with their students. But we did change the funding model. We said you will not be able to ask us, if these are your students, to do some of the things for you that we do now. You'll have to handle the UCAS operation yourselves in the way that we've previously done it. And we reduced the percentage take, already regretting that phrase, so help me out if you by imagining that I'd said something different, quite significantly. And then invited the colleges to say that they wanted to buy back additional services at sort of 1% increments until the former level of funding was in fact reached. The average level of share now between ourselves and our partner colleges is about the same as it was, because they said they wanted those things. There was no pressure from us to take those services back. They felt it made either economic sense or sense in other terms to do so. So I think it's partly a matter, this business of higher education and further education, of cleaving to your last in difficult circumstances and being wedded to the notion of partnership. If you don't believe in the value of partnership, then everything I've said is completely unpersuasive, in a sense, because it's a values-driven set of statements that I'm making. In the Hefke thing that we did, the bringing the tapestry together, systemic partnership, and I was thinking earlier on actually about higher and further education partnership. I was imagining some kind of learned paper on kind of interstitiality in liminal space kind of coming out of this, but if you're not attracted to that, I won't pursue it. Successful collaboration. It's got to be clear to us both what we want from it, and that it is open to us to get it. It must be an even-handed, fair-minded arrangement. There must be a reasonable degree of strategic fit in the purposes of the partners. And I think that that is easier to achieve collaboratively than competitively. If it's straightforward free market competition, you kind of have to reconstruct the strategic fit post facto, as it were. Whereas if you set out with overlapping, not identical, I'm sure, but overlapping goals, it's much easier to derive benefit from both sides. It needs to be very strongly, as it was in our case, endorsed by the most senior colleagues in each case. I'm not going to read out every single one of these. There needs to be recognition and respect for organisational and sectoral culture difference. It's not, and this is a thing that worries me in a sense about some aspects of the debate about HE and FE and who should do what. Because I don't see the point of us all turning into each other. I can't understand how turning FE colleges into universities adds to the value of things, particularly. It might make sense in the strategic case of an individual institution. One of the things that happened to some of the post-1992 universities when they became universities is that they felt themselves subject to very intense pressures to become different kinds of institutions from the ones they'd been. And it's been quite difficult in the case of some of us to resist some of those pressures. So the desire for difference and diversity of mission seems to me to be valuable. And I would particularly point to the last one, because it connects with what I began by saying about being patient, taking a long-term perspective, remembering why you came into the room in the first place, and sticking to that. Almost there. There are innumerable challenges and difficulties to resolve in all of that. I'm not going to adumbrate them all individually. I'm going to move to what is in fact the last slide, and to try and suggest that there are compelling reasons in altered circumstances for continuing to work together. And they are partly about values, about integrity and consistency. They are certainly about widening and participation and progression. We have to be careful that in increasing the independence and difference of different kinds of sectors and institutions, we don't elaborate barriers and difficulties for learners so that they can't get from A to B. I take the point about the foundation degree being a qualification in its own right, and I want to know that you can progress from it. I don't want to choose between those two things. I think that unless we can operate in that way, we will not deliver the higher skills that we need. We will not deliver the social justice that we are pursuing. So I think it makes economic good sense. If we don't do it, our energies will be dissipated. Our clarity of purpose will evaporate. We will become uncertain. We will miss opportunities. The policy context will become ever more incoherent. It will become more and more difficult for the public to understand the offer that we make to it. And the other thing that I fear that we will lose, or it might be just me, if we don't do this, is our marbles. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.